I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. It's President's Day, and just in time, C-SPAN has ranked them all. For many, it comes as no surprise that the number one pick is, once again, Abraham Lincoln. His executive order, known as the Emancipation Proclamation, freed the slaves, but it took the 13th Amendment to end slavery. Today, we'll look at the political struggle to abolish what Frederick Douglass called the great sin and shame of America. Then we'll check in with Harvest Public Media reporters, from Trump's pick for Agriculture Secretary to GMOs to even defining milk. We'll find out what's happening with the food being served at your table. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. How exactly was slavery abolished in this country? We know it happened as a result of the Civil War in a document that President Lincoln signed in 1863 called the Emancipation Proclamation. But something else had to happen, too. 2 years after the proclamation was signed, the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery became law in this country, and the struggle over passage of that 13th Amendment was anything but predictable, our guest today says. Michael Vorenberg is an assistant professor of history at Brown University in Rhode Island. He's author of Final Freedom, The Civil War, The Abolition of Slavery, and the 13th Amendment. He was a research assistant to David Herbert Donald for his prize-winning biography on Abraham Lincoln, and he's been described as the unsung hero of Steven Spielberg's film on our 16th president. And Michael, so good to have you. Happy President's Day to you.
Happy President's Day to you, Steve, and thank you for having me here.
You know, you've spent a lot of time in your career studying the actions of Abraham Lincoln. Just last week, C-SPAN released another ranking of presidents from our best to our worst, and once again, Lincoln ranked number one. How deserving of that number one ranking do you think he is?
I think he deserves the ranking number one. I think he always has. And I think he'll probably hold on to that position for a while. If I were doing my NCAA brackets, I'd definitely be putting him on there.
What do you admire most about him, again, having spent so much time watching him and reading about him?
I think he is extraordinary in the way he meditated on issues and thought deeply on issues before taking action. In many ways, he had the sort of chess player mentality and knowing how to play politics. Mm-hmm. And we know that about Lincoln. But at the same time, that quality, which we now associate with a politician in a very negative way, was paired with the really deep compassion and reflection of a true sage, of a wise man. And I think that's something it's very hard to see in a leader of any place. And for Lincoln, it's what I just said has been said often, but it still holds true. And as other leaders have come afterwards, his greatness has been, I think, shown even more.
I always wonder with folks like you who have dived so deeply into one part of our history or another, if Lincoln was alive today and you could spend 10 minutes with him, what would you want to ask him? What would you want to know about whatever moment in his presidency or his life that would make a difference to you?
I'd have a lot of questions about sort of historians type, that is, small issues that we're still debating.
Right.
Of course, like many, if the issue were today and he were alive, we'd ask him what he thought about this or that. And I think that's the kind of question I get the most often is, what would Lincoln have thought about this? What would he have done about this or that? The times have changed, so this is a very difficult, really an impossible question to ask. But the issue of what would Lincoln do or what would Lincoln say remains with us. I'd have a number of questions, mostly I think having to do with the period immediately following Lincoln, Reconstruction, and his thoughts on that, and if he could assess the way things played out after his death, what would he say in terms of the politics of it, the policies that played out, and then the decades of the late 1800s when a lot of the reforms that Lincoln had been so instrumental in pushing forward were rolled back or attacked until you get legalized segregation, disfranchisement, mm-hmm. et cetera. What would he have made of all that? Because these were things, these kinds of issues were actually on his mind while he was alive. So they weren't issues like what would you have thought about the automobile or traveling to the moon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, there's all this confusion, it seems to me, over exactly what Lincoln wanted to do about slavery, Michael, during his first campaign for the presidency and then even afterwards once he got the job. Did he enter the presidency with an aim toward a permanent end to slavery, or did that develop over time? What do we know?
He entered the presidency believing that slavery was morally wrong, and he had always believed slavery was morally wrong. Then the question becomes, what do you do about that?
Mm-hmm.
And Lincoln believed that if you stop slavery from spreading, it will eventually die. Now, that's a different kind of means than saying we're going to abolish it everywhere, which he did not believe was the proper route to take. And that was mainly for legal and constitutional reasons. He did believe that the Constitution, as it stood, allowed slavery to exist in the southern states. But he also believed that the federal government had the power to regulate and constrict slavery in the territories. And so he believed that if you stop slavery there, that slavery would eventually die, that this is an old idea among free soilers and Republicans then, which is that if you effectively keep the snake in its hole, the snake will die.
Hmm.
If you allow the snake, whatever evil beast you want to call it, to spread, then it will thrive. And so for him, it was about abolishing slavery when he came in. But the way to do that was to restrict slavery. And so that's why his entire campaign is about restricting slavery in 1860, and not about abolishing slavery. And he, of course, was denounced by his opponents as wanting to abolish slavery everywhere. And that's what the many white Southerners said he would do.
At what point then did he turn the page? Did he say, no, we're going to go farther than just restricting slavery. We're going to get rid of it altogether?
Well, Steve, that's sort of the million-dollar question that historians try to figure out is when did he do that? And certainly there are those critics of Lincoln at the time and even people who are critical of Lincoln now who said that was always his agenda, that he was kind of acting as a stealth president. He came into office and just immediately set out to do what you just said, which is to abolish slavery everywhere. I don't think that's true. The crucial thing here that hasn't been mentioned is that there was a war, and that war changes everything for Lincoln. The movement toward abolishing slavery everywhere is incremental, and it comes about as war policy. Lincoln says it's a war policy. I think we have to take him at his word. It doesn't emerge immediately as a war policy. In fact, there are certain commanders in the field, U.S. commanders in the field, who make moves towards emancipation or emancipating slaves in certain areas. Lincoln says that's got to stop because he understands that strategically, politically, it goes against the interests of the U.S. in his belief. And so eventually, though, what he comes around to is thinking that emancipation on a limited basis, where slavery already exists, is acceptable and constitutional because of the war. But he gets there slowly, and he takes that policy then incrementally from that point. And that point really comes in about a year into the war.
Mm. Do you fault him for that incremental approach to abolishing slavery or not?
I think it's tough to judge Lincoln in that case. I don't fault him. I think that he was a very careful politician and a lawyer and a constitutionalist.
Mm-hmm.
That's who he was. He could have gone faster. There's no question that he could have moved less incrementally and more in steps. What if he, as soon as the war breaks out, simply says that all states in rebellion, slavery will be abolished there. That is to say, what if he issues a even broader emancipation proclamation a year or more before he actually does. And then we're into this counterfactual, which is how would that have changed the war? How would that have changed his presidency? He thought, and he may have been right, that if he did something like that, something really quick and expansive, that he would have lost the constituency he needed to keep the Union together to fight the war. Mm. And I think that's true. That is the crucial area being the border states. And in the border states, by that I mean states that stayed in the Union, did not secede, and where slavery was still legal.
Like Missouri.
Missouri is crucial. Kentucky is even more important. Right. Lincoln famously said, I hope to have God on my side, but I must have Kentucky. So he believes that if he acts in a very aggressive way too quickly, that he'll lose those border states. And that's hugely significant. Border states like Kentucky or Tennessee, which did secede but was slowly brought back into the Union, these states sent more men to fight in the Civil War than any other states, because they were sending men both ways, of course, to the Confederacy and the U.S. So he understood that to lose these states was to lose the whole game, and that I think is a quote from him. And the so he's got to be very careful there.
So he's playing chess on three different levels here. Am I tracking that right?
Yeah, but Steve, maybe you should say what those three different levels are in terms of, you mean like three-dimensional chess? Is
He's navigating a lot of things at once. It's not just as simple as saying, we're going to get rid of slavery tomorrow. He has to think of other things very seriously before he does that.
Sure. He's a number of things at one time, right? He's the president of the United States. And that means he represents all the people who are loyal to the United States. He's not representing a district. And that means he has an obligation to represent those people who are still in the United States, and that includes people in the border states. At the same time, he's commander-in-chief. The Constitution makes him so. He believes that as commander-in-chief, in fact, this is part of the oath of office, that he has a duty to uphold the Constitution, and that means upholding the Union, meaning doing whatever he has to do to keep the Union together. If states have seceded, then he has to do whatever it takes to nullify that secession. He refuses to accept that they've actually left the Union, so it's all about making sure that you create loyal governments there. If we want to say bringing the states back in, that's fine. But he's got to keep the Union together. And that's what he says publicly. I put Union above all else. So he's commander-in-chief fighting a war for that end. Finally, he is a reformer. Since his earliest days, he's been for all sorts of reforms. Obviously, he has said that slavery is wrong. He has taken stances on issues including temperance. He's not a strong reformer. He's not one of these abolitionists or anything like that. But he certainly is he's sympathetic, let's say, to certain types of reformers, not extremists by any means, but to certain reformers. And coming from the Whig Party, which is where he came from, that's a natural thing for him to be, is sympathetic to a number of the reformers of the time.
Michael Vorenberg, who's from Brown University, he's an historian, he's an author. We're talking about Abraham Lincoln and his fight for the 13th Amendment. Michael's the author of the book Final Freedom, The Civil War, The Abolition of Slavery, and the 13th Amendment. And just quickly, Michael will be speaking tonight at 7 at the University of St. Mary up in Leavenworth. More information on the university's website. But if you want to go see and hear Michael, you can do that tonight. You know, there's this notion in our history, Michael, that passage of the 13th Amendment that abolished slavery was just a natural byproduct of Lincoln's presidency and of the Emancipation Proclamation. But you say it was anything but predictable. And I'm wondering why you say that.
We accept that slavery, of course, was abolished because of the American Civil War. Maybe not immediately, but that the Civil War played a role in that. And then we ask ourselves, well, how did that happen? And we go first to the Emancipation Proclamation. That's natural. It's probably the document that Lincoln is most famous for issuing. That document comes, the final one, on January 1st, 1863, is when he signs it. So Lincoln himself says a number of times up to the signing, after the signing, that this does not abolish slavery everywhere. In fact, the document, if you read it, is very clear that there are, for example, exempted areas in the South that are not touched by this, where slavery will still exist. And the border states are all exempted, but so are counties in Louisiana, Northern Virginia, a number of other places. So it did not abolish slavery. Even if it were accepted as law, it doesn't abolish slavery everywhere. But then that other problem there I just said, it's if it's accepted as law. Lincoln also worried about that. It is a presidential order of wartime issued by the commander-in-chief, which means if the war ends, then the proclamation may have no effect, and slaves who are not yet free may never be free. In fact, there's the real possibility that slaves that have been free could be re-enslaved. Lincoln was worried probably less about that, but nonetheless, he was worried about how you make it permanent. He was less worried about that than other reformers. That is, there were many reformers right away who said this proclamation doesn't go far enough. The Woman's Loyal National League, for example, a hugely important reform group during the Civil War, pushing for emancipation from the beginning and other reforms, they circulate a massive petition after the proclamation. They want a law. They want something that makes emancipation permanent so it will outlast the war. It'll touch all slaves everywhere in the United States, and it will assure the end of slavery. So you have a petition there. Lincoln just wants this war to be won, and then he wants to deal with emancipation as it comes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's so it's not predictable in that way. Is it going to be by a law? Is it going to be by more proclamations by Lincoln? And really, no one in this early period after the proclamation is talking about amendment to the Constitution.
I was going to say there are these different options on the table here to deal with the abolishment of slavery. And the constitutional amendment, as you just said, Michael, is just one of those options. What swayed things in terms of going for a constitutional amendment?
So first, from a legal standpoint, for Lincoln, the obvious route towards getting this done legally is to do it by state action, state by state. And so the idea is that as every state now in rebellion gets a new loyal legislature, and he's orchestrating this from above. He's getting new loyal legislatures in Louisiana, Arkansas, Tennessee. And so he envisions that as this happens and as states try to get back into the Union, they're going to pass new constitutions, and these constitutions will be anti-slavery. So it'll be done by state action. That's a slow process.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fast enough for a lot of the anti-slavery activists and for African Americans themselves, of course, the activists in the North, and of course, former slaves who want their freedom made certain. So we have here a couple different impulses. One is from, I'll call them abolitionists and anti-slavery activists who want slavery permanent. But then you have to remember Lincoln has this opposition party, the Northern Democrats, and he needs the Northern Democrats because they support the war. They don't like Lincoln, but they do support the war, and they do have an important constituency. They have a major objection to the Emancipation Proclamation and to all of the policies, saying it's unconstitutional. And so there are anti-slavery Democrats who believe that getting rid of slavery as a way to beat the Confederacy is a good idea, but it must be done legally. And it's from them that they say, look, the way to do this legally is to follow the Constitution to the letter, and that is to have an amendment to the Constitution. So it's actually some of the opposition members from the Democrats who come up with this idea of the form, if you will, of the amendment to the Constitution.
And that was a bite of the apple in those days from reading your book, because in those days, the Constitution had not been amended very often. It was viewed as this sacred text that maybe a lot of people thought shouldn't be messed with.
It had been 60 years, Steve, since the Constitution had been amended. And the document had achieved this revered status that, you know, you just don't touch it. Lincoln himself, in an earlier debate in Congress, when he was in Congress, said that this is not a document to be changed without tremendous deliberation and process. So, again, it wasn't the obvious method to use. And it's a remarkable thing to use this method in its way. When I was doing my research, one of the things that surprised me was this, that an argument made against the amendment, mostly by Democrats who were what we call peace Democrats, people who were against the war quite a bit, was that you simply can't amend the Constitution to do something that the framers themselves rejected. That is, the framers themselves considered the slavery issue. They thought about it.
They walked away.
And they walked away. So for a later generation to come back and revisit an issue that they actually talked about and to reverse their decision was unconstitutional, as opposed to something that the framers didn't anticipate, let's say. And so this was a whole different kind of amendment to the Constitution. And once you move in this direction and say, look, everything's up for grabs, you can amend the Constitution to do things that go against what the framers would have accepted, it opens up this huge can of worms, or this huge potential, if you want to put it in a positive way, set of reforms. And that's what happens. You get suddenly proposed amendments for women's suffrage. Of course, women's suffrage has been around for a while, but the idea of making an amendment to the Constitution, amendments to prohibit alcohol, what have you, all the reform movements that have been around for decades now cast in the form of an amendment to the Constitution.
And that's what people were worried about. It would open up a huge can of worms.
I don't know if they were worried about that particular thing about an amendment to the Constitution. That no one anticipated, I think. They were worried, I think, that if you kept on pushing the slavery, in this case, Lincoln and his administration, if you keep on pushing this anti-slavery issue, then it will divide the country. Just let emancipation play out along the lines of the proclamation, along lines of the actual activities of the war, and emancipation will happen. If you push this thing too hard, then it will end up being divisive in politics. That's right. What Lincoln worried about. And so he was very slow to get behind the amendment, not because he didn't support it. He absolutely supported it, but because he worried, and it turned out quite rightly, that this could be a divisive issue. And it was. It was a very divisive issue in his reelection campaign in 1864.
Historian Michael Vorenberg is my guest. We're talking about the fight for the 13th Amendment that abolished slavery on this National President's Day here. Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Let's go to Jim from Lenexa. Jim, you're on with Michael Vorenberg. Good morning.
Hello. Hey, fascinating show.
Good.
I have a question for the professor. He worked in the movie Lincoln as a historical advisor, so I wonder if he had some insight into this. In the movie, I think to build dramatic tension, when the vote for the amendment is coming up in Congress, the state of Connecticut is unwilling to vote in favor of it. But I always thought that Connecticut was actually a strong advocate for the amendment. Was that done for dramatic reasons, just to put a pause in the movie, or for the tyranny of the alphabet that the letter C comes early?
Thanks for the question, Jim. I should say, first of all, I was not a historical advisor for the film, but I appreciate the compliment, thinking that I was. It's okay. They were excellent historical advisors. It just happens that my book was used by the screenwriter as a source. He used other books too. But anyway, let me get back to the question. The question's an excellent one because it raises a number of issues. And you're absolutely right. When the final roll is taken in the film and Connecticut votes and the delegates there vote against the amendment, there's a few things going on there. I'm not a screenwriter. I can't tell you why it was done that way. I suspect, and I should say, by the way, that the delegation voted for the amendment, not against it. So that was historically inaccurate, but that's okay. There were other things that are historically inaccurate. I do think it was for dramatic attention, right? You try to make a roll call in Congress a dramatic moment. How can any screenwriter do that? So, so one way you do it is you have the votes beginning by setting you up by saying, look, here are some people from Connecticut, of all places, a northern state, voting against it. And then you have the audience wondering, my goodness, is this going to pass? Is it not going to pass? So I suspect that's the dramatic issue. And it's true that there were plenty of northern delegates who did vote against it. They were all Democrats. Not all the Democrats voted against it, but those who did were all Democrats. And this became a bit of a controversy because a congressman from Connecticut, when the film came out, was very upset that his state has been presented in this way as a pro-slavery state, if you will, refusing to vote for this amendment, and he wanted that scene revised for when the film came out on DVD, which I thought was rather interesting how that would go, and would that then set a precedent? Of course, it wasn't revised. He was also on some weak ground because to suggest that Connecticut was an absolutely abolitionist state was a problem. Connecticut had stood very firmly, for example, against suffrage for any African Americans on its own prior to the Civil War, during and just after the Civil War.
Right.
And so it's a bit of a canard to then focus on this small misstep in the film.
I have a couple points I want to get to just in the short time we have left. What did you think of the film, Lincoln, by the way?
I thought it was a fantastic film. I think that to make a sort of dramatic potboiler of a film that's based really mainly around actions around, in Congress.
That's tough.
That's very tough.
Yeah.
I think my greatest admiration is for the screenwriter, Tony Kushner. I think he wrote an amazing script to take this episode and to kind of blow it up. And so you can really understand who Lincoln was, what Congress was like to some extent, and what Washington was like. It had its flaws, and there have been plenty of historians who focused on those flaws. I don't want to take up a lot of time taking that on. But as a film, as a piece of drama, recreating that moment,
right,
I really thought it was wonderful. There were a couple flaws that I think rose to the level of distortion that was unneeded, and probably done for dramatic effect, but really still weren't needed, that created a misrepresentation of the moment. But otherwise, I think the film was great.
And Michael, just finally and quickly here, the passage of the 13th Amendment didn't come for 8 months following the end of the Civil War. Lincoln has been dead now for a number of months as well. That'll surprise some people. It took that long. Just quickly, why?
The states have to ratify, right? So that's what the Constitution says. And so you need 3/4 of the states to ratify. The resolution submitting the amendment to the states goes out after Congress votes on January 31st. And so then you need 3/4 of the states. So a lot of people say, well, gee, the 13th Amendment passed. It didn't pass on January 31st, the date of the vote, of course. It doesn't, as you just said, Steve, it doesn't get ratified till December. So why does it take so long? Well, that's complicated in a number of ways. Right away, a number of northern states ratify it. But then you have to have the state legislatures in session to ratify it.
Okay.
So that's a problem.
Okay.
But the biggest issue is the southern state legislatures. Are they going to ratify or not? Are they going to be allowed to vote on ratification? So that had to be worked out. The southern state legislatures, as they are reforming in the South under Andrew Johnson, the successor to Abraham Lincoln, they have to take up this issue. And they end up being very slow to do it, and only when deals are promised to them by Andrew Johnson.
Interesting. Michael Vorenberg again speaks tonight at 7 o'clock at the University of St. Mary up in Leavenworth. I'll talk more about all this. Michael, that's a great way for us to spend part of President's Day. Thanks very much for taking some time.
Thanks for having me, Steve. It's been a lot of fun, and I hope to see some of the listeners tonight at University of St. Mary's in Xavier Hall at 7 o'clock.
Sounds good. Okay. Time for a break here. When we come back, we're going to talk agriculture with our team from Harvest Public Media. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back to the show. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's program, we checked in with political legend Nancy Kassebaum and how advances in genealogy research are helping African Americans trace their enslaved ancestors. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we bring you special programming from the BBC's The Response, covering America's health concerns under the new administration. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, President Trump has his pick for Ag Secretary, and he's not from the Midwest. It's former Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue. The Senate has yet to confirm him. To understand what Perdue could mean for farmers here in the heartland, we're bringing in Jeremy Bernfeld. He's the editor of Harvest Public Media based here at KCUR. He's joining us this morning via Skype. And Jeremy, good morning. Nice to have you.
Hey, Steve. Good to be here.
So who is Sonny Perdue, Jeremy?
Well, as you mentioned, he's a former two-term governor of Georgia. He grew up on a farm and has been involved in agriculture and farming since then. He has a doctorate in veterinary medicine, and then he's also owned small businesses that deal with like agribusiness and transportation since his time after he was governor. But also a bonus fun fact, Sonny Perdue had a cameo in the 2006 film We Are Marshall when he played a football coach.
Not bad. That certainly qualifies him. As you mentioned, he's from Georgia. He'd be the first Southerner to lead the USDA in about 2 decades. Ag secretaries have most often come from the Midwest. Is that important here, or are we losing something?
Well, Steve, it could be. We don't know a ton about Sonny Perdue's agricultural priorities yet, or the Trump administration's for that matter. The thing to think about is that politics in our food system have historically often broken down less among political lines and more along regional lines. So take, for example, Tom Vilsack. He's the former governor of Iowa. He was the ag secretary for the entire Obama presidency, obviously a Democrat. He was a huge backer of ethanol. That's super important for Midwest farmers because we grow lots of corn here in the Midwest. His influence, Vilsack's influence, really influenced the bottom lines of farmers and changed a lot about what the land in the Midwest looks like. So it's not that ethanol is going away now that there's going to be a Southerner in charge of the USDA, but Vilsack was a really big proponent of that. And being from Iowa, I think, was a large part of that. So we really don't know what the future of ethanol looks like, just as an example, with a Southerner kind of coming in to take control.
How might our food system look different with a Sonny Perdue at the helm? Jeremy, have you had a chance to crunch that yet?
Well, as I said, we still don't know a lot. You mentioned that Perdue has yet to be confirmed. His confirmation hearings aren't even on the books yet. I think I would expect them probably next week, but it's still up in the air. So we really don't know a lot. And even though he was governor of an agricultural state in Georgia, he doesn't have a ton of kind of marquee, agricultural policies to his name. The thing that I think is interesting is that Sonny Perdue is seen as more of a traditional Republican than the Trump and the Trump team. The agriculture industry, for instance, is really a really big fan of trade deals. The industry is really dependent on immigrants and refugees. Obviously, those are in stark contrast to the way that President Trump ran. So I think there's hope in the agriculture industry, at the least, that Perdue will kind of bring those views to the Trump cabinet.
I just wanted to note that Sonny Perdue, should he be confirmed, would be responsible for helping shape a new farm bill. This is obviously a very big deal in that the bill funds everything from, crop supports to food stamps. And this has proven to be an especially contentious process in recent years, getting these bills passed. Is work on the bill already underway, or where does all that stand, Jeremy?
Yeah, so the bill runs out next year, so it's time to start drafting a new farm bill. It's actually going to really start to take shape now in D.C. There's also a hearing. Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas is the chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee, and so he'll have a big role in shaping that. One of the first hearings they're having in farm country will actually be in Manhattan this week. So that's really heating up. The thing to think about when it comes to the farm bill is that Republicans control Congress and the White House. That obviously hasn't happened for a very long time. In the recent past, many Republicans have tried to use the Farm Bill to cut funding for food stamps and things like school nutrition programs. Those are gigantic programs, and the Farm Bill is seen as the place that authorizes that funding. It's a place where you could potentially rein in that spending. So with Republicans in control of these branches of government, it might be, time to expect further cuts in those programs. So, you can't really pass a farm bill without the nutrition programs. That's been proven in the past, so I wouldn't expect them to be slashed, but that's definitely something to watch for.
So there's no reason at this point to think that Sonny Perdue would not be confirmed. There's no raging fight beneath the surface that's taking place out there right now.
So I would expect that Sonny Perdue would be one of the easiest confirmations for in the Trump cabinet. We've obviously seen a lot of resistance to many of his nominees. I don't think we'll see that from most Democrats, and I think farm state Democrats are generally in favor of Sonny Perdue. He's made the rounds in D.C., and you've seen some of the influential farm state Democrats, like those in Minnesota, like those in Michigan, have had, by all accounts, pleasant meetings. That said, it has taken a very long time for Sonny Perdue to even be named as the nominee. And then even since then, it's not that the confirmations have really sped through. So I don't know why that is, but that gives me a little bit of pause.
Yeah. Well, that's Jeremy Bernfeld from Harvest Public Media giving us an update on Donald Trump's pick for Ag Secretary. Jeremy, thanks very much.
You bet, Steve.
You know, one other big issue that's affecting our food systems right now is a controversy over milk. That's right, I said milk. And the controversy has a lot of dairy farmers white-knuckling it right about now. On the phone to tell us about it is Harvest Public Media reporter Luke Runyon, who's based at KUNC in northern Colorado. Luke, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You've done some recent reporting on milk, and you say there's this war brewing over what folks pour on their breakfast cereals each morning. How so?
Well, it all boils down to how we define that word, milk. So this is a debate that's been going on for decades, but it's finally seems to be coming to a head. And the fight is really between dairy farmers and the companies that produce dairy alternatives, like, you know, your soy milk or your almond milk.
Right.
And the dairy farmers say that almond milk is kind of an imposter, that it's not really milk, and that the companies who make it are being deceptive by calling it milk and making shoppers think almond milk is just the same as dairy milk from a cow.
You know, can you milk a soybean, Luke?
Well, that's exactly what the dairy farmer
that's the argument here, yeah.
talked about, yeah.
How much almond and soy milk and other alternatives to good old-fashioned milk are being sold in this country these days?
Well, the latest numbers are for 2015, and a market research firm put almond milk sales at just under $900 million that year, and soy milk at about $300 million. And then if you add in all of the other varieties, it's an industry that's worth about $1.5 billion. But it's important to note that dairy milk still makes up the lion's share of the market. In 2015, it was at about $17 billion in sales.
Oh, but so those it's sales huge. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and have been slipping for decades, and that's kind of put dairy farmers on high alert about these imposters.
But a lot of folks, including yours truly, can't drink regular milk for a whole host of reasons. I mean, that's not the fault of the dairy industry, but it's simply become a fact of life, right?
Yeah, and dairy farmers are just kind of reacting to changes in the market. So they're seeing these different alternatives coming in. They're seeing growth in these competitors in the marketplace. And so I think they're saying, you know, we want to see some changes here.
And they want to see what happened here, Luke.
So the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, has these definitions for what foods are. So if you look up in the rules, the FDA has a definition for milk, and it says that it comes from a mammal. And so the dairy farmers say that they want to see the FDA actually enforce the rules that they already have on the books. And you've already started to see some of the dairy alternative makers change the wording on their packages, kind of seeing these, see what's the writing on the wall.
So you couldn't call soy milk milk. It would be soy juice or rice juice, or is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, some of these companies have started calling it like an almond beverage. I don't know if I've seen juice yet, but kind of avoiding the use of the term milk to avoid any sort of lawsuits that might pop up.
Mm-hmm. So do you think the dairy farmers are going to wind up getting their way here?
It's very possible. The dairy industry has enlisted Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin from where else but Wisconsin,
right,
to introduce a piece of legislation which they're calling the Dairy Pride Act, which would basically force the FDA to revamp its standards for what milk is and what it isn't, ban the almond milk and soy milk makers from calling their products milk, and then force the FDA to come in front of Congress to do progress reports on how they're actually enforcing the rules.
Hmm. Hey, Luke, before you go, you had a really interesting story about Fort Morgan, Colorado, and a town that's seen this tremendous growth of immigrants and have opted to embrace those immigrants coming into their community. Tell us just a little bit about that story.
Yeah, so we at Harvest Public Media are kind of spending some time post-election and in this first few months of the new administration to look at this urban-rural divide, which was one narrative that came out of the election that people sort of used to explain the outcome. And so we wanted to go to rural areas and talk to residents about how they're feeling about the new administration, and just life in rural America in general. So I went to Fort Morgan, Colorado, which is a meatpacking town, and it's incredibly diverse. I spent most of my time at the high school, which is about 70% non-white, but it's in a really rural area. And a lot of the diversity comes from the agricultural economy. So people coming in to work farm jobs from Central America, there's a large refugee population from East Africa, and it's become a melting pot of sorts where people are really having to learn how to live in a small town with a lot of diversity.
That's interesting. Well, that's Harvest Public Media reporter Luke Runyon, who's based at KUNC out in Northern Colorado. Luke, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
And finally today, drive past a field of corn or soybeans in the Midwest, and you can be almost certain that they are genetically engineered. That's been the case since the 1990s, but now GMO foods are moving from the field into your kitchen. Grant Gerlach is here to tell us, fill us in on that story. He's Harvest Public Media's reporter at Net News and joins us from the studios of Nebraska Public Radio. Grant, welcome.
Good to be with you again, Steve.
You've been watching genetically engineered foods and for a while now, and you say that we can expect to see more of these foods at our dinner tables. What's behind that?
Well, I think the first thing that's behind it is a change in the science of how foods are being genetically engineered. And the difference between these new foods, these new crops, and the old crops is, if you think about those corn and soybeans that you mentioned, those were done using what's called transgenic technology. That meant they took a piece of DNA from another species. In the case of herbicide-resistant corn or beans, it was from a piece of bacteria. They took a gene from the bacteria and put it in the corn, and that made that corn resistant to this herbicide. Hmm. The new kinds of plants that are coming out, they're just changing the genes within that plant itself. So no new genes coming in. In the example of this apple, they're just adjusting in a very small way the genes within that apple to have the effect that they're looking for.
You know, the goal then is to market directly to those of us in the grocery store. Do I have that right, Grant? I mean, are there other GMO foods that we can buy directly that isn't in prepackaged products?
There are a handful of examples at this point. So the Arctic apple is the latest. Already in stores, you may see the Innate Potato by the company Simplot, and it's engineered to be bruise resistant. Huh. There's a papaya. Most of the papaya grown in Hawaii now are genetically engineered to be virus resistant because there is a virus just wreaking havoc in the papaya plantations there. And a new one that is planned by Del Monte, the fruit company, is a pink pineapple that's engineered to have more lycopene in it. And lycopene is a nutrient that's red, that makes tomatoes red, watermelon red or pink. And there's more of this lycopene in the pineapple, makes it look pink.
Wow. So if I go to the supermarket, how am I going to know if I'm looking at a GMO product or something else?
It can be a little difficult to tell. You are seeing more voluntary labels on some foods. It might say something like produced with genetically engineered ingredients. That's the kind of thing you can see around the store. But in the case of these apples, it's just going to be a QR code. And those are those square codes that look like the barcode labels kind of. You can scan that with your smartphone, and you can go to a web page with information. But it doesn't exactly scream that it's genetically modified, does it? That is how following what will be the labeling law that was passed by the Senate last year. So they're working on rules that are based around these QR codes. So in that sense, it's following the rules, but it may not – well, it's not as much information as a lot of consumers would like.
Tell us, you've mentioned this golden, delicious apple a couple times here. What's the change that's being made, and why should I care about this?
So it's called the Arctic Apple. You may see it in stores. It's gone out to a few select markets, just test markets at this point, in the form of apple slices. And what's different about this apple, it looks just like any other Golden Delicious apple, except that it doesn't brown when it's cut. Huh. So if you think about leaving apple slices out on the counter for an hour or so, you're going to have some browning on it. But that doesn't happen with these. So that's how they've genetically modified it. It doesn't brown.
And that's happening because why? I mean, little kids don't like to see their apples turn brown, right? They won't eat them once they've browned.
Yeah, so what happens is apples contain an enzyme. They create an enzyme that causes that oxidation when the apple is cut. And what they've done with this apple is genetically engineer it so that it doesn't produce that enzyme. So it doesn't create a preservative. It's just the absence of this enzyme that makes it that it's a non-browning apple. And the way they do it is a process called RNA interference. And this is something that's being used more often in agricultural breeding. Basically, inside the genes of this apple, there is a piece of RNA that controls the production of that enzyme that causes the browning. They add an extra strand of RNA, just a replica of that strand, and basically cancels it out. It's like flipping off a switch when it comes to that enzyme production. Hey. So it's just that the only difference is that extra strand of RNA.
Can you taste a difference?
Have you tasted it? As far as I understand, I've never tasted it, but as far as I'm told, it tastes like any other Golden Delicious apple. And it's also farmed the same way as any other Golden Delicious apple. It's just like any other conventional apple is grown in an orchard.
Well, I guess the billion-dollar question here then, Grant, is this notion of, you know, are consumers going to care here? Because these products have been on the market for a while now. Anyway, GMOs are nothing new here. What's your sense of where all this is going and how the public is reacting to it?
Well, yeah, GMOs are nothing new. Neither is the controversy over GMOs. So just as with any other genetically modified food, there's going to be a segment of consumers that just don't want a GMO apple. And it is true that the vast majority of consumers want clear labels on their foods if they contain GMOs. So that's something that the company may have to deal with.
And that fight over labeling, Grant, is that mm-hmm. still continuing, this notion that consumers aren't getting the kind of clear information they really want?
Well, there was the labeling law in Vermont that some people may remember. It was going to have stronger rules than this law that was passed in the Senate. But this federal law that was passed precludes any state from passing their own labeling laws. So while definitely consumer groups are not pleased with the result at the Senate level, at the federal level, but at this point there's nothing else that that states can do to get different kinds of labels required in their stores.
Well, that's interesting. That's Grant Gerlach. He's with Harvest Public Media. He's a reporter at Net News and joins us from the studios of Nebraska Public Radio. Grant, thanks for the update. I sure appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And thanks to all the Harvest Public Media reporters for joining us here this morning. You can listen to previous programs and download our podcasts. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow we'll bring you an installment of the BBC program The Response, which lets people tell their stories in their own words using the tape recording app on their smartphones. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatakoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.